Well, I remember once as a kid being taken by my mum to the cinema to see, remember having my mum read to me one of the original Sherlock Holmes mysteries. And I'm talking about the classic old school version, not the modern TV series, which I like as well, but I'm talking the Victorian genius in his tweed hat, when London was lit by gas lamps and taxis were pulled by horses, that kind of thing. And in one of the original mysteries, this woman has hidden some letters in her house, and he needs to know where they are. And these letters are incredibly valuable, the most precious possession she has. And he has worked out that they are in one particular room, her main living room, and he tries lots of methods to discover the exact specific location in that room, but she's too clever, and he can't find them. And this is how I remember it anyway. In the end, he waits for an occasion when she has lots of guests in the room and it's full of people, and then he walks past outside and he slips a smoke bomb through the open window, and then while staring intently at the woman starts yelling at the top of his voice, "Fire! Fire! Fire!" And there's panic in the room and everyone starts shouting and running back and forth, and then he just slips away. And afterwards, his sidekick, Dr. Watson, says, "Holmes, what was that about?" And he says, "I just needed to know where she would look." And sure enough, in the chaos, before she could check her instinct, she had glanced over to where exactly the letters were hidden and given away their location. If you've lived in this fallen world for more than 5 minutes, you'll know it can sometimes feel like the smoke bombs have been slipped in and we're being bombarded with screams of fire, fire. Whether it's, you know, losing friends and loved ones, or relationships breaking down, or health problems, or financial strain, or anxiety over the kids, or anxiety over the future, or maybe just anxiety over what's happening in the world news. And like the woman in the story, times of crisis have a funny way of revealing what is most precious to us. So when life seems to be going wrong, the question is this: where are we going to look? Where are we going to look? What is most precious to us? What will we choose to value most? Well, this evening, God's word is going to turn our gaze onto what really is the most precious, valuable thing we have, the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. If you have everything but lose him, you have nothing. If you lose everything but have him, you have everything. And the more we choose to look at him in the chaos of life in this world, the more it won't faze us. The more we'll preserve our joy and our peace and our hope and our strength, the more we'll have the joy and privilege of walking with him and honoring him. It really all comes down to fixing your eyes on Jesus. That's what Hebrews 12 says. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Or, to quote Pilate in John 19, "Behold the man." As you all have picked up by now, in this series going through John's Gospel, John the author loves irony and sarcasm and double meanings. And irony is a very powerful communication tool. It's a great teaching tool. The Gospel is dripping in it, John's Gospel. And lots of phrases have deeper meanings if you stop to look at them more closely. And one example is what Pilate utters at the end of verse 5, "Behold the man." Or as that phrase is very famously known in Latin, "Ecce homo." Now, what Pilate meant by that phrase was pity. He was trying to get the Jews to lay off Jesus. Jesus is standing there. We're going to get into all of this in a second. We'll work through verse by verse. But Jesus is standing there, deserted, disowned by his own disciples, beaten, face covered in blood from the crown of thorns, a figure of mockery in his royal robe put on by the laughing soldiers. And Pilate saying to the Jews, "What could you want with this clown? He's pathetic. Look at the guy. Ecce homo. Look at the man." At the same time, those flippant, throwaway words of Pilate's, in fact, have a very profound meaning for all of us. That is the most valuable, vital thing any of us can ever do in life. Behold the man. And so for the next few minutes, we're going to take a leaf out of Pilate's book. We're going to ecce the homo ourselves. We're going to gaze upon the person of Christ in these verses and see what we learn. Three main things. Here's the first, if you're filling in the blanks on the handout. That Jesus Christ is the true king. That's the first big thing John is showing us by the way he tells this account, that Jesus Christ is the true king. Again and again and again, the theme of Jesus' kingship shines out of this passage, and John's irony is in all of it. On the surface, it's all just a joke designed to mock Jesus. Deep down, nothing could be truer. Have a look at verse 2. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head, so a crown, and arrayed him. It's a pretty grand word, isn't it? Arrayed. Well, after all, he's a king. Arrayed him in a purple robe, purple being the color of royalty. Verse 3, they came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And by the way, that mimicked their official salute, which was in fact, "Hail Caesar." They're saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Then verse 5, the crown and the purple robe are mentioned again. Then verse 7, the Jews complain how Jesus made himself out to be the Son of God. In other words, this kingly figure of ultimate authority and power and glory. Then verses 8 and 9, Pilate suddenly gets kind of shaken up and disturbed about what is Jesus' true identity? You know, what if he is more than just a pathetic nothing? What if he is a supernatural king? Then verse 10, Pilate raises the issue of authority, and Jesus remarks that even the great Pilate, Roman governor, one of the most powerful men in the world, has this much authority over him, apart from what's given him by God in order for the crucifixion, God's plan of the crucifixion to happen. You're getting it? King, 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 all the way through the theme. Verse 12, the Jews again raise the issue of Jesus' kingship while still denying it. Verse 14, Pilate says, look at verse 14, Pilate says, "Behold your," anyone? "King," thank you, Jackie. Verse 15, Pilate says, "Shall I crucify your," anyone? "King." Then verse 15, the chief priests are so ruthless in their efforts to get Jesus executed, they even openly deny their own belief in any Messiah when they say, "We have no king but Caesar." So all the way through, king, 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 king. It's what this passage is screaming at us, the theme of kingship. And it reminds us that Jesus Christ really is God's eternal king, majestic, powerful, authoritative, ruling over events, even his own execution here, orchestrating events around him, even as he himself is put to death. We've seen that in previous passages too. And therefore worthy of our trust and our worship and our entire lives. But the fact his kingship here is presented in such a sarcastic, ironic way in these verses also makes the point that as then, so today, his kingship is hidden. It's not just a kingship, it's a hidden kingship. As then, so today, many people scoff at the idea that Jesus really is God's appointed king of our universe. And so, as then, so today, we should expect his kingship to be met with what it's met here, mockery and disbelief, opposition. We shouldn't be surprised by that, even in the Bible Belt, shouldn't be put off by that. But this passage reminds us that despite appearances, he is our living, powerful, magnificent king. When I was a kid, I remember my mum once taking me to the cinema. This is the story I was about to begin the sermon with, to see the movie Shine, all-time classic of the 90s about this pianist. And it's a true story about this Australian pianist who was an utter genius, musical genius, but who partly because of that suffered a big mental breakdown and was confined to a mental institution for years. And the movie opens with him years later, after he's been released from the mental institution, walking down the street somewhere in Australia in the pouring rain and looking through the window of a restaurant and noticing a piano. And he's drawn to it And he can't help it. And he walks in and he sits down at the piano and the restaurant goes quiet and everyone's looking at him. And he plinks and plonks a couple of notes. And then people start quietly laughing at him, viewing him as pathetic. He looks kind of weird as well. He's in a dirty old shapeless overcoat. There's a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He's totally bedraggled from the rain. He looks like a nothing. And just when people are mocking him and dismissing him, returning to their meals, he suddenly breaks into this stunning, virtuosic performance of this impossible piece for piano called Flight of the Bumblebee, arranged for piano. And his hands are just a blur. And this magnificent sound pours out of the piano, fills the restaurant, and everyone is transfixed. And forks stop midway, halfway to people's mouths. People listen, open-mouthed, they're stunned. His real identity, his true magnificence, are suddenly evident. He's the real deal. Jesus looked like a bedraggled nothing. Everyone dismissed him. He is the real deal. So, you know, is he sovereign over whatever unsettling things are happening in world news right now? Whatever the latest is between Israel and Iran, for example. Is he sovereign over the evil and the opposition against the one true God in our world and the persecution against his people? Is he sovereign over all the minuscule details in your lives, some of which we thought about at the very start? It might not seem like it on the surface. It doesn't seem like he's much of a king on the surface here. Yes, he is sovereign. He is the true king. So we can hand all of those things over to him, as Ryan and Hillary just led us to do in the prayers, and trust him with them and wait and watch to see what he does with them, how he uses them for good, maybe in us. Often in us, God will use tough circumstances that don't seem to be under his control. When everything seems to be going wrong, he uses that in us to refine us. Maybe in those around us, unbeknownst to us. And one day we'll see how at the end of history, with all the authority in the universe that he has, he reverses all of the sad and evil things and wipes away every tear forever and replaces it with perfect joy because he is the king. And then we learn two things about this king. So here's the second of our 3 points. He's the king. Secondly, who took our nature. He took our nature. In other words, he became human. While being fully divine, he added to himself a human nature. He became flesh, as John told us back in chapter 1 at the very beginning. He was the God-man, as the theologian Anselm put it in the 11th century. And in these verses, John lays his humanity utterly, brutally bare in the form of his suffering. So, you know, the flogging in verse 1, the thorns in verse 2. And by the way, these aren't the annoying little prickles that you get in your backyard. Middle Eastern thorns like this is likely the spikes from the date palm. They can grow up to 12 inches in length. They would have sliced open his scalp and made the blood run in rivulets down his face. So we've got the flogging, the thorns, the slaps and punches. Verse 3, that's just the physical suffering. Think about the relational suffering. You know, betrayed by the very people who should have recognized him the best, the leaders of Israel who knew the prophecies the best, and then failed by the cowardly, pragmatic Pilate who theoretically stood for the law and order that should have protected Jesus. If you've ever been betrayed by someone who should have welcomed you, if you've ever been failed by someone who should have protected you, Jesus knows exactly what that is like. He knows what you've been through because he entered the full human experience, suffering and all. And then on top of the physical suffering and the relational suffering, here we see the emotional suffering as he stands there throughout this passage, abandoned by his disciples, mocked and humiliated, not just a physical punch bag for the soldiers, but a verbal punch bag too, for all the sarcasm and hatred. And one commentator describes it like this. Pilate's presentation of Jesus was designed to appeal to the pity of the crowd. So Pilate's trying to get Jesus off the hook by saying, look, he's pathetic. Ecce homo, look at the guy. What do you want with him? I'll read on. This commentator says, "But his appearance would have gone beyond the pitiful to the ridiculous. That broken figure with his tattered robe and weird spiky headdress protruding grotesquely from his head, more like a clown than a king. It was with mocking laughter ringing in his ears from the soldiers' ridicule that Jesus appeared for the further mockery of the crowd, a figure of shame and humiliation." And so his suffering, even just at this point, before we get on to the rest of chapter 19, physically, relationally, emotionally, before it ramps up even more, shows us his weak, vulnerable, authentic humanity. He joined us in this fallen, fractured world and plunged into the human experience without holding back. When he came down, he came all the way down. So he knows what you're going through. He's not like the aloof deities of other religions who look down coldly, detached, impersonal, and unfeeling, unable to empathize. He's not like so many other worldviews and approaches to life which are devoid of meaningful comfort. You know, I recently heard about an accident in which a mother lost her young son. And in the aftermath, the mother was kneeling by the son's body and weeping uncontrollably and repeating over and over again that she could have borne anything except this because her son was her life. And about that incident, a leading Buddhist scholar wrote these words, quote, "We cannot help but sympathize with her, but there is little we can say in consolation. All we can do is wait for time to veil her grief in the mist of resignation." That's the best most secular people have as well, isn't it, if we're honest? You know, a shrug of the shoulders, maybe time will heal, cry a bit. What else is there to say? We don't have to settle for that. In Jesus Christ, we have a God who is truly with us, who can truly relate to us in our sufferings, while also having the authority to A, use them now, and B, one day end them. And that brings us to our final point. In these verses, we see a king, that was point one, who took our nature, point two, third and finally, so that he could take our place. He took our nature so that he could take our place. God the Son took our nature, in other words, became human, so he could take our place. In other words, represent us, be our substitute before God for our sin. You know, yes, the incarnation is a great source of comfort, as we've just explored. Ultimately, that's not what the incarnation was for in the end. Ultimately, the main point of the incarnation is our redemption. He took our nature so that he could take our place. And we see this in John 19 in a few ways. For example, notice how the events here, as well as being literally true, are very symbolically meaningful. Jesus was found guilty before the judgment seat, verse 13, as a criminal and condemned by a judge to die. Well, of course, he experienced that not just before Pilate, but before the judge, the ultimate judge of the universe, found guilty before his judgment seat, but not for any sin that he had of his own. You know, we should have been found guilty before the judgment seat as criminals. We should have been condemned by the judge to die. And yet, in this passage, we see that exact position that we should be in already taken by Jesus. Did you notice the two charges brought against Jesus in these verses? Essentially, they boil down to number one, blasphemy, verse 7, number two, treason, verse 12. Now, that is the fundamental dual nature of all human sin. That's what you and I are guilty of, blasphemy and treason. Blasphemy, we behave like we're God. We want to be in control of our lives. We want to have autonomy to set our own standards, make our own rules. We act like we're God. And treason. We rebel against the true God, shove him off the throne of our lives so that we can sit there ourselves and replace him. So the charges that we face before the judgment seat of God are basically the exact charges that Jesus faces here before the judgment seat of Pilate. The second person of the Trinity took on flesh and became human so he could stand in our place. And so let me ask you this. How does that make you feel? You know, how joyful, am I for that? How grateful am I for that? How much is my identity centered on that instead of anything and everything else that people in this world have as their identity? There are myriad of things, and they're growing fast, of what people use for their identity. Is my identity, Jesus took my place? It's the most important thing about me. Before my gender, my age, my color, my ethnicity, my orientation, you know, Jesus took my place. That's my identity. But I think the most important application of all of this final point is to check once again so carefully that my faith for God to accept me isn't in being a good person, isn't in being in a Christian family, isn't in being baptized and giving money and knowing my Bible and going to church and serving in church. None of these things will release me from the judge's rightful condemnation of me. It's like, you know, someone commits murder, they wind up in court, and the judge says, what's your defense? And they say, well, I helped an old lady across the road the other day, and I do nice things sometimes, and the judge is like, okay, you're free. Like, none of those will get us off the hook. Because the only thing that will get me into heaven is trusting in Jesus' substitution of me in my place. And so let me finish with this. You know me, I'm a Brit and love to go back a few centuries. So let's go back to the 17th century, 1600s. And Oliver Cromwell, the guy running England after the English Civil War, sentenced a soldier to be shot for his crimes. And he stated that the execution would take place at the ringing of the curfew bell that night. However, when the evening came, the curfew bell never rang. Turns out the soldier's wife had climbed up into the bell tower and clung to the great clapper of the bell so that when they were pulling on the ropes and slamming it against the sides, it wouldn't ring. Well, when it was discovered what had happened, Cromwell was angry, obviously, and summoned her to explain her actions. And as she showed him her bruised, battered, bleeding, beaten-up hands, she started to weep. And Cromwell's heart was touched. And he said, your husband will live because of your sacrifice. Curfew will not ring tonight. Well, for those of us trusting in Christ, it won't ring for us ever. Ecce homo. Behold the man.